From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. On today's show, tackling big problems. Homelessness is a pretty big problem for 18 to 24-year-olds and growing. We'll talk about how Kennesaw University is trying to help their homeless students. Also, race relations in the U.S. appear to be getting increasingly worse.
We live in a world where we simply believe that white people's lives are worth more and that black lives aren't worth much.
Morehouse Professor Mark Lamont Hill joins us to talk about his new book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and beyond. And speaking of race, Gwinnett County is the most diverse in the southeastern United States, but you wouldn't know that if you looked only at its elected officials. Now a federal lawsuit claims the county is drawing voting districts to reduce the impact of minority voters. That is all coming up this hour. First, though, the opera Alice Riley from the Savannah Voice Festival is about the first woman hanged in Georgia. She is said to haunt Wright Square in Savannah, where she was killed. And we wanted to hear your ghost stories. So here are your first thoughts. Nick says he spotted a famous ghost while working as an intern at the old Senate office building in Washington, D.C.
I'm staring at a spitting image of Abraham Lincoln. Now I'm thinking that there are a lot of weird people walking around the hallways of Washington, D.C., and this is just another one. But he was about 4 feet away from me. He had his chin on his hand, and he was like, kind of didn't know where to go. And he goes down to the end of the corridor and hangs to the left. I went down to the end of the corridor and looked, and he had disappeared.
So according to Nick, Honest Abe is known to wander the halls of the White House. Maybe he got a little lost there. We always want to hear your ghost stories or other stories. You can call us like Nick did at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comment on the show. Tuition costs are rising, student loan debt is mounting, and that makes a college a tough financial decision for anyone. But it's nearly impossible for the 58,000 or so college students who were homeless last year. That's the latest number from FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. Kennesaw State University recently unveiled a first-of-its-kind housing facility to help students at risk of homelessness. And Marcy Stidham joins us. She's the director of the Campus Awareness Resource and Empower Center, CARE for short, at Kennesaw State University. Good morning, Marcy.
Good morning.
CARE is new.
CARE is only 5 years old, so
yeah.
It's pretty new. It's grassroots, and not many places have that kind of program.
Right. We couldn't find any other place that offers this particular kind of program. And when you say grassroots, this started because you had one case, one student that
yes.
you needed to help.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I got a call from our residence life director. He asked, do we help homelessness? And even at that point, I said, there's campus homelessness. And so,
because you had dorms, you thought if they needed a place to live, they'd go live in the dorms.
Of course. And I do have, as most people do, I assume kids or students in college had the same experience I did. So I start with that one student, and now we've served hundreds.
Do you have a total on how many?
Well, between the campus pantry, we serve over 150 students almost every year.
Which is exactly as it sounds, a food pantry where they can get food assistance.
Right. And then with our homeless program, we've served, right now, for the past 2 years, we've averaged over 80 students each year. And out of that 80, about 14 last year, we were able to help with financial assistance through our donations. And then we also help foster care youth who are matriculating into college. And right now we're servicing 10 students who are in foster care.
Tell me how the program works. It is temporary, is it not?
The campus apartment is temporary. It's a 14-day cycle, but we can extend it if we need to. But the goal is on a Friday when I typically get referrals for students who are homeless, that's the average, I need to have some place to put them for the weekend so that they have a safe place to stay. And then during that time, myself and my intern MSWs and also my case manager that works with me, we look to find more long-term permanent solutions. And it takes about 2 weeks to do that.
And when you say long-term permanent solutions, you're trying to find them housing or you're trying to find them a job? Or what are you finding for them?
Both. The first thing we always look for is a job, because if we put someone in a housing setting and they can't afford it, you've set them up for failure. So we start looking almost simultaneously for a job. Some of our students have two. We actually have one right now I can think of has three jobs while they're going to school. And then we also at the same time are looking for housing options. Thankfully, KSU has year-round housing. So for a lot of our students, if we can get them on campus, that resolves that homeless situation for them. But for other students, we look for off-campus housing, especially if they have children.
So there has been an increase of 75%, 75% increase in homeless college students in the past 3 years. That's, again, according to FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. You're working one-on-one with many of these students. Any idea why such an increase?
One, they know to break the poverty, the cycle of poverty, they need to go get a college education. You can't. Everyone lets you know you really need an higher education, you know, technical degree at minimum, 4-year degree, just so you can be able to have the American dream.
Okay, so that more students who may not have gone to college before and may have fewer resources are now going to college.
Yes, and college became easier to get into in 2007 with the College Open Access law that passed in the federal government. Also, we have a lot of students who are specifically on our homeless side. They have homeless liaisons from K through 12th grade. And so that's a federal mandate. Every publicly funded K through 12 school in the United States has a homeless liaison. They're doing a phenomenal job. And those youth are doing well. A couple of years ago, the average graduation rate in Georgia was mid-70s. And the graduation rate for the homeless youth was in the high 70s. So they're doing better than average. So they, too, deserve to go. I've met students who are robotic scholars, but they're homeless. So it doesn't mean they're not capable. It's just they don't have the same access to resources.
And they may not be able to get a student loan.
Right.
Even if they did, they may not want to, since the nation has $1.3 or so trillion dollars in student loan debt.
Yes. There's a huge fear with this new recession group. These are kids who have lived through the new recession. And so they are very afraid of loan and borrowing. So they're trying to muster it up by themselves. And so they're a great crew of students to work with, but life has happened to them indeed.
We would love to hear from you out there listening. What suggestions would you have to help homeless students? Were you ever homeless or couch surfing as a college student? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation at Facebook. My guest is Marcy Stidham. She's director of the CARE Center at Kennesaw State University, which is a very unique program to help homeless students. And I've read that part of the problem with homeless students is the stigma attached to it, that it is sometimes difficult to get kids who are homeless to actually come and seek help. Have you found that to be true?
Yes, it's extremely true. They have to self-identify. So that means you're telling someone who is trying to not be labeled, you have to accept a label. And to accept that label, then you have to accept help. And they're trying to they're determined to make sure that they can make it on their own.
They don't want to be called homeless.
They don't want to be called homeless. They just want to be normal. I mean, doesn't everybody? And so they deserve to be treated normal. And so I give them a lot of respect and a confidentiality as best as I can to protect them. And then what happens is I have some students, as you saw with the stories that they told on television last week, they were willing to tell their stories because they said, we need people to know what you are doing for us so other people will come out. And that has happened. Since the stories have come out, we have talked to probably 10 or 12 students who had some different issues. Some students were just dealing with basic poverty issues, but we have now assessed 3 or 4 students who are literally homeless. Like a young guy came to the office yesterday with just a suitcase. That's all he has. That's everything.
So where do most of the students go? Where do you place most of them? Do they end up in dorms? Do they end up in an off-campus apartment?
Most we work to get on campus housing. The majority, like I said, we don't give everybody financial assistance because this is completely functions as a nonprofit within the confines of the university. So we live off donations. But the majority we help to get on-campus jobs. And that is just a saving grace right there so that they can have employment and have pride that they are investing in their own future. But we do look for off-campus housing. If a youth is about to be evicted and we've assessed, okay, if they get evicted, they have nothing else, we try to prevent the eviction and help them get at least caught up and make sure that they can afford forward going.
You very quickly skipped over the fact that you guys exist by donations. I was surprised to see how many donations come in from actual Kennesaw State University faculty and staff.
Isn't that awesome? Yes, they're wonderful. Most of our donations are $25 a month, and you just don't know how much that small donation means, because those dollars add up to me being able to help a student stay in housing, purchase a meal plan, get a gift card, different things like that. So it is amazing.
What do you make, though, of this change in our educational function? And this is not just happening in college. This is happening in schools as well, where you're not just in charge of what's going into a student's brain, but faculty and staff are having to think about their life, where they live, the kind of clothes. Many schools have started installing, I'm talking about grade schools, have started installing washers and dryers.
Yes.
And here it's even gotten to the college level. Mm-hmm. And this is not something that they really had to deal with or were responsible for 20, 30, 40 years ago. What do you make of that?
I think society has changing. You know, it does take a community to raise a child, and I think the community is so overstressed and overburdened right now. Parents aren't able, don't have the same access to resources that they used to. Families are dispersed, they're displaced. When you're working with homeless youth, sometimes their parents are incarcerated, or sometimes the whole family is homeless. When you're talking about foster care youth, something had happened to that family where now they're a ward of the state, but it doesn't mean that child is not capable. So I think society is changing, and educational system, we have to adapt and we have to change with it, or we're going to be teaching on a 1970s model in a millennial style, in a new millennium, and that the new student now is coming with complex issues, mental health, substance abuse history, but they also come from a place of poverty, and the recession is a big factor in that fact. But I think it's very inspiring that people who come from such struggles are trying to be a part of and be a productive member of our future society. So,
but what kind of pushback do you get? Because you can imagine someone saying, look, maybe if they're homeless, this is not the right time to go to college. And you're nodding your head. You must hear this quite a bit.
Yes, yes. It's gotten a little bit less. But in the beginning, there were people saying, well, then they need to go to somewhere else. They need to go to go get a job.
Yeah.
It takes a while to get a job. And now most jobs, you need a degree. And if you're bright, but I go back to him and I say, but if you're bright enough to be an engineer, I've had students who are health science majors and nursing majors. If you're smart enough, why does your situation dictate your future? Shouldn't we all be able to launch from where we are? Even if you need a little bit of a hand up. No, my kids don't get a handout. They come back and they pack bags just like everybody else so they can help other students get food bags. And they donate their time. And I've had some of my graduates bring back food because they're paying it forward. They're investing in these youth because they know what we're trying to do. So, again, they deserve it. If you're capable and it takes a small investment, that's what you should see it as. It's a small investment and the return is great.
That is Marcy Stidham. She is director of the CARE Center at Kennesaw State University. Marcy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. This month marks 2 years since a police officer shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Inequalities in our criminal justice system have dominated headlines since then. But my next guest says the injustice goes beyond police policies and prison sentences. He says there's actually a war on the powerless in this country. Mark Lamont Hill is a distinguished professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College and author of the new book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, From Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. It's always a pleasure, Mark. Thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks for having me.
I want to first tackle this definition of nobody, because although your book focuses a lot on race, you do not keep it confined to race. You say that a nobody, when you're talking about the vulnerable, includes Black, poor, trans, queer, or other people marked as disposable. Who are the nobodies that you're referring to?
You know, It really is all of those populations and others. You know, we live in a world where certain people, or a nation more specifically, where people are rendered disposable, where certain people's lives simply aren't worth as much as others. We live in a world where certain people's misery can be erased or relocated to places where we don't have to see it. We hide their misery. We live in places where the state doesn't make them less unsafe, but rather more unsafe. These are the kind of things that make you nobody, whether you are a young black man walking down the street in Sanford, Florida, or whether you are a trans woman in New Orleans or Minnesota, you know, trying to make it down the street, or whether you're a poor white worker in Flint, Michigan after the auto factory shut down. We're all struggling to make it, and this designation of nobody shifts across time and space. You know, within certain contexts, some people are rendered nobody, with others are. And I want us to keep track of those things and understand that this condition of nobodiness isn't just an act of bad luck or one set of poor legislative decisions, but it's deeply rooted in American history and really in a nation that distributes resources and goods based on very troublesome criteria at times.
You make a very well-researched and documented case for the fact that the United States, the people in power, have actually been choosing who is a nobody and who is not. What is it that guides that choice? How does America, and how has America over the past, say, 100 or 150 years, chosen who will be forgotten?
You know, I think that choice is interesting, right? Because I don't think it's choice at the level of, you know, backdoor dealings or the kind of secret society, Illuminati kind of narrative that sometimes pervade popular culture. I think what it is that we live in a nation that defends class at all costs. And if you're defending class at all costs, then what happens is you have a certain population that is exploited and exploitable. Their labor gets exploited. Their jobs get outsourced more quickly. The protection that's afforded certain populations isn't afforded others. So it's not, for example, that a town or that a government said, hey, let's put lead in the water in Flint. It just so happens that when you have a nation, again, that's now obsessed with certain conceptions of efficiency, what we call a kind of neoliberal ideology, what ends up happening is they find the cheapest way out. And the cheapest way out is to have an emergency manager rather than an elected official once the state becomes insolvent. The cheapest way out is to get a cheaper water resource, even though it has as many as 15,000 parts per billion of lead, when you're only supposed to have 15 parts per billion of lead. I mean, you're talking about, just astronomical levels of poison in the water. That didn't happen because people wanted to poison black people or people wanted to poison poor people. It happened because people are indifferent to the suffering of those people. And that is what I want to capture.
It's really interesting when you're going back through decades, really. And I want to hearken to one particular part in your book when you're talking about the rebuilding of St. Louis. And this is right around the time of the suburbanization of America. And you quote this study done in 1948. And there's a line from the study in which it said there's a problem because, quote, people going and coming from work are offended by the state of decay they witness on all sides. And they're talking about some of the slums in the heart of St. Louis. But they don't mention people. They're talking about an eyesore. They're talking about these people's homes as eyesores without mentioning them as humans. And they're talking about them as a problem for the wealthier people traveling into St. Louis and out. How many examples of this did you find?
So many. You know, St. Louis, for me, became an example of this nobodiness and this idea of civic blight and sort of and seeing the conditions of the urban vulnerable as not a civic crisis because they're vulnerable, but a crisis because they're an eyesore to the wealthy. That kind of circumstance wasn't just St. Louis. I focused on St. Louis because it's connected to my ground in Ferguson. And the Pruitt-Igoe housing projects are all part of that kind of attempt in the 20th century to redress these issues. And it ultimately becomes a failed project, a failed liberal project, as well as a failed conservative project, but largely a failed liberal project when we talk about that particular attempt at public housing. But when you go around the country and we could look at the Taylor homes, we could look at Cabrini Green in Chicago, we could go down to St. Louis, and we see very similar circumstances. Again, this isn't an isolated incident. This isn't historically unprecedented. but rather it's part of a really deep and consistent pattern that cuts across various slices of American life.
And yet you talk about something called post-intentional racism, which sounds like something, a phrase that academics would use. So I hope you'll bring it back down to ground for us. Post-intentional racism, in some cases you've said you're not really worried about the intentions of some of these actions, but the consequences. What does that mean?
You know, it's a really significant point, I think, to make that, you know, everything doesn't happen at the level of intention. I think given our media cycle, given the way we have these sort of celebrated cases, we're often looking for the kind of sexy, foaming at the mouth, you know, TV-worthy incidents of racism where somebody says, I'm going to go kill a black person, or I'm going to shoot a Mexican running away. You know, I'm going to punish all Arabs. I am going to have a special level of scrutiny against Mexican judges, for just hypothetically. and that kind of ideology is a particular sort of racism. But then there are other ways in which, despite a person's lack of racist intent, they may not have any inherent belief in the superiority of blacks over whites, at least not at the conscious level, or whites over blacks at the conscious level. But nevertheless, they're invested in a set of cultural practices, a set of psychological beliefs, that allows racism to occur even when they don't mean it. Sometimes it's embedded in our economics. Sometimes it's embedded in our popular culture. I'll give you a perfect example. When if a jury sits in a jury box and watches George Zimmerman, right, and they say, you know what, George Zimmerman is not guilty because I, as a reasonable man, would have done the same thing that he did under those circumstances, right? It's not racism. It's not that George Zimmerman was some crazy executioner.
George Zimmerman was the citizen who shot and killed teenager Trayvon Martin in Florida. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Thank you. And what's interesting is, of course, in the law, we invoke the reasonable man standard, right? A jury of your peers will say, well, what would a reasonable person do under those circumstances? And the problem is, with when we think about this in the context of post-intentional racism, legally, he's free. He's not guilty. In terms of legal ethics, it's appropriate, right? Because the jury says, hey, we would have done the same thing. The problem is, part of why they would have done the same thing is because deep down in their psyches, they find black bodies in public space as a form of terror. And so it's not that they think that, and they would have done the same thing to a white person if they had been equally terrified. The problem is, oftentimes white bodies and black bodies are read differently in public space. And so even if I could say that the juror is deeply connected to some psychology of racism, I would argue that the law itself is neutral on the issue. The law is facially neutral on the issue. It doesn't say it doesn't invoke a different standard for blacks versus whites. But what it doesn't account for or allow for is the human subjectivity of white supremacy in America. It doesn't allow for the fact that the reasonable person standard might actually be a proxy for particular types of white anxiety against black bodies. And black anxiety, too, because a whole bunch of black folk might be scared of Trayvon Martin, too. The problem is, there was no reason to be. He was carrying Skittles and wearing a hoodie, not a weapon. But that becomes part of the problem. So just because you pass the racist test and you say, I'm not a racist, doesn't mean that we don't have to wrestle with forms of racism in society that are deeply embedded.
My guest is Mark Lamont Hill. He's a distinguished professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College, along with a ton of other titles that you've taken on, Mark. I don't know when you sleep. His new book is called Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. And here's where we get to another really interesting part of your book, and it's where you talk about the pliability of the law. And you talk about the fact that there are not inherent crimes, that there are actions that we include as criminal actions. And explain to me how this relates to a war on the vulnerable.
Right. I mean, people don't commit crimes. There's no, I don't know, platonic realm of forms where, like, all crimes exist outside of human history, right? Or people commit acts. And certain acts get criminalized, and they get criminalized at different times. Drinking alcohol, one moment is a crime, other moment it's not a crime. It's the same act, it just got criminalized at a certain point. Teaching people to read, particularly black people, was a crime at a certain point. Marrying across your race was a crime at a certain point.
So women showing their ankles used to be illegal.
Exactly, right. Same ankles now, just not a crime. And so what happens is, as a society, we often construct things as crimes to meet certain needs and to reflect certain values, certain morals, etc. And when it comes to the most vulnerable in our society, we not only create more we not only invoke more crimes that snatch up the vulnerable, but we also enforce those crimes in a different way. So, for example, a nice middle-class person, if I were to follow them over the course of their day, they'd get in their car, and if I followed them on the highway, they probably would not always be four car lengths away from the other car. They might not always signal before they change. They might roll a stop sign or two. If I really wanted to follow them for 20 minutes on the highway, I could find something to pull them over for. You know, they may go camping with the families, and they may bring in publicly store and refrigerate certain foods, which violates in many states, you know, public storage laws. And I could go on down the list and find lots of stuff. They may go home to their living rooms and smoke marijuana in a state where it's not decriminalized. We could go on down the list. And they likely wouldn't be ensnared in the law. There's a great book called 50 Felonies a Day, which talks about that the average person commits 50 felonies that are on the statutes right now. But when it comes to the vulnerable, we over-police. We spend all of our resources and time within those communities. And if we look long enough, we'll find reasons. That's how an Eric Garner gets stopped for selling Lucy cigarettes, or Alton Sterling gets caught with CDs in Baton Rouge, or Walter Scott gets stopped for not paying child support. And it led to these awful death sequences. But nevertheless, they were very minor offenses that don't get policed in other neighborhoods.
So, Mark, we have this tweet from a listener named Roy Lee, and he says, quote, "White supremacy hasn't stopped Asian immigrants from being highly successful in America," end quote. This seems to be saying, why have blacks not been able to find success despite white supremacy the way that Asians have? What's your response to that?
Well, I think first we have to talk about what we mean by Asian, because we often take the word Asian and cast a very wide net. If I were to look at Hmong Americans, for example, if I were to look at Cambodian Americans, their educational outcomes, their socioeconomic status is actually not unlike black people. In fact, in many states, it's worse. If you look at, for example, Milwaukee, Asian populations like the Hmong are below African Americans in literacy rates, job access, et cetera. You know, there's a great amount of work in Philadelphia on Cambodian Americans, and it's the same thing. So we don't want to cast such a wide net with Asians, because Asia is a very large place. And when we start talking about South Asians versus, we're going across the board. But for people who are successful, I mean, there is a very large, we have to look to history. One of the things I do in my book is I situate all of the current moments within against a historical backdrop. So when you come to a country and you have the support of your nation state coming in, when you arrive in a country and the new country has economic investments for you or facilitates economic investment for you, that also creates a different set of circumstances. Asian populations didn't have to deal with the legacy of slavery here in America. My father is 88 years old, and his grandparents were slaves. So, I mean, being two generations out of slavery, you're dealing with a different set of socioeconomic barriers. Black people just got the right to vote in a very legitimate way, 51 years ago after the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So, I mean, we're talking about a very different set of circumstance than, say, a Korean immigrant who comes over in the 1970s or the 1980s. It's just a very different set of circumstances. So I think it's apples and oranges. But there are also an extraordinary number of black people who have been successful. There is a black middle class. There has been a black elevated class since the 1960s. The problem is it has come at the expense of the most vulnerable of our community, and that's what I want to keep track of, the most vulnerable.
And we only have about, say, a minute and a half left, but that leads us to the question of why, no matter how many black celebrities there are, for example, that doesn't translate to a better opinion of African Americans in general. And you say that's because for certain individuals who are successful, they get accepted into the not nobody class, right?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, some of us are seen as exceptional, right? I mean, there's the old Spike Lee movie, Do the Right Thing, where, like, this guy's a foaming at the mouth racist, but he loves Michael Jordan. He's like, well, he's Michael Jordan. He's not really black. He's Michael Jordan. Or, that's Oprah, or that's whoever, right? And I think we can fall into that idea that we have these exceptional people. And in some sense, we say that they transcend their blackness. We tried to do that with President Obama, in fact. But then there's also the piece really fast that there's a way in which we have to keep track of that, actually. There's a way in which we have to say that irrespective of your economic position, we're still grounded by race. We're still caught up in the snares of race. It doesn't mean that we can't get out of racism. It doesn't mean that racism can't end. It doesn't mean that the world can't get better. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you can't be successful, but it does mean that there are legitimate barriers for all of us, black, white, red, yellow. We have to do that. And it's not just race, it's economic. And at the core of this book is an economic argument, not a racial argument. I'm saying that as long as we exist within a class-dependent state, as long as we have a neoliberal ideology, we're going to have a world where nobodyness prevails.
Right. That is Mark Lamont Hill. It is a fascinating book, highly recommended. He's Distinguished Professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College. The book is Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, From Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. Mark, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. Gwinnett County is the most diverse county in the Southeast. It's one of five counties in Georgia where no single racial or ethnic group holds a majority. African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians make up more than half of that county's population. But there might be a disconnect there between the citizens and their elected officials. Last week, three civil rights groups filed a federal lawsuit against the county. They claim Gwinnett's district lines weaken the voting strength of the area's minority communities. Almost 75% of the county's black, Latino, and Asian voters are located in one district. And this is not the first time Gwinnett County has faced this issue. Last April, I spoke with a pair of advocates about how representative a district's lawmakers should be. Jerry Gonzalez is the executive director of the Georgia Association of Latino Elected Officials. His organization is part of the lawsuit. And Helen Ho is the former director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice in Atlanta. I also spoke with Emory political science professor Andra Gillespie. And I started the conversation by asking Helen about the challenges that face non-white voters.
I think what the problem is that we know that there are a lot of immigrant Americans in Gwinnett County and elsewhere that just aren't voting. They're not engaged. They're not coming out. There are a lot of reasons for why there's a lack of engagement. I'm happy to talk about it. But I do believe one key thing is that they don't feel like there's anyone on the ballot that they believe really resonates with them, connects with who they are and the things that they want represented in government. So it is extremely important to have a representative sampling of people both running and leading our political districts.
And yet, Jerry, you could ask the question that, look, wouldn't it also be racist to think that a white person couldn't represent a Latino or an Asian American as easily as a person of color?
Well, I would say that it is important for people to select their own candidates of choice. And unfortunately, systems are put in place to prevent that from happening. Not having language access further dilutes the Latino and immigrant population voting in Gwinnett County, for example. So the county is purposefully not reaching out to these counties. The candidates are not reaching out to the voters. And that further depresses the vote and doesn't engage the electorate in a way that would produce a more reflective environment to represent the changing demographics in Gwinnett County. That has to change. The current situation is unsustainable. It is going to change. People should elect candidates of choice. Sometimes those candidates of choice will be non-white. Sometimes those candidates of choice will be white. It depends on making sure, as Helen said, that the candidates are addressing the values and concerns that the voters care about. And that's not the case right now in Gwinnett County.
Okay, I should mention at this point that we did reach out to Gwinnett County. They were unavailable for an interview. Their statement was, it's very important people participate in their government at every level, staying informed, voting, volunteering, running for office. That's the comment from Gwinnett County. We reached out to the Gwinnett County Sheriff's Office. They were unavailable for an interview. And we reached out to Renee Unterman, who's obviously represents the county. And she had a lot of things to say. And we're going to go into those more because she was used as an example, I think, by you, Jerry, in the National Journal piece. But Andra, let me go to you. And one of the reasons that this is coming up, this topic is even of concern right now, is because the face of America is changing, right? Gwinnett may be one of the first, but we're going to see this flip in racial demographics change all across the country, perhaps here in Georgia first. And we have also seen in places like Ferguson and elsewhere how sometimes that disconnect of demographic of one, I guess, demographic running a county while another one are the citizens can cause issues. So from a political science perspective, how do we kind of put this into context? What's the problem here?
So in the 1950s and 60s, political scientists proffered this theory called pluralism that suggested that as demographics of a community change, then you would see the older group that had held power step aside for the newer, larger group to kind of come in. And they used places like New Haven, Connecticut as an example for that. And many scholars studying race and politics, in particular in African-American politics, really challenged this idea. And if they'd had the examples at the time that they were critiquing this in the 1970s, they would have used Ferguson as an example of a place where you see the demographic shift happen, and then it's years before you actually see the political shift kind of come to the forefront. So they argue that there are other things that are going on there. In a place like Gwinnett County, you have the issue of immigration. So you have to see how fast people are naturalized and then how fast they're actually assimilated into the electoral system. And so what we see there is that there's a lag. And so that's part of the reason why you see the underrepresentation of Latinos and actually also of Asian Americans as well. But then there's also this larger partisan shift that has not happened in the county. And so because one party tends to kind of have an advantage in Gwinnett County in terms of electoral outcomes, and that's the party that most minorities are not represented in, that
the Republican Party?
Yes, that's also going to be reflective of sort of this imbalance that we see in terms of descriptive representation. One of the ironies is that Gwinnett County has elected an African-American Republican to the state legislature. But because there are so few minorities sort of within that county Republican Party apparatus, that's actually also going to put minorities at a disadvantage as well. So the question sort of becomes how to create a robust Democratic Party that's actually able to win elections. How do we reach out to minority voters and mobilize them to turn out to vote in elections? So we know from public opinion data that Latinos and Asian Americans are far less likely than blacks or whites to be actually mobilized or contacted about voting. And how do we educate new populations so that they are comfortable with the process, so that they participate in numbers that are commensurate with their levels in the population?
Okay, there is a lot to get your mind around in this. But Helen, let me talk about how we end up with a slate of candidates in a place like Gwinnett that are mostly white. Mm-hmm. Does that have to do with which candidates' parties back? I mean, it costs money to run, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of factors. And I do want to clarify that when we talk about that there's a lack of diverse representation, we're talking about elected officials from Gwinnett County down.
Right.
We do have state and congressional elected officials that represent parts of Gwinnett County that are diverse, but county and local elected officials are not, with the exception of one African-American man in the city of Norcross. But back to your question about what does it take to run, I think, just as the professor mentioned, oftentimes our community members are not even touched or reached out to. You got to think about it. Immigrants and refugees, you're talking about people that are not from here. They arrived here at a certain point. They don't have the length or depth of connections or relationships that some other, groups in power do have. And so there needs to be more intentional outreach. We'd had a nonpartisan candidate for candidate training in Gwinnett, 17 participants, 9 of whom were immigrant and refugee Americans, 7 of whom were Asian American, 5 of whom were African American. So for us, there are people of color wanting
to
run.
Yeah.
And half of them were from Gwinnett County. So I think groups like ours are doing everything we can to provide the information, motivation, and training to get people up to where they need to be. But two, at a policy level, yes, there are systemic issues that need to be addressed either at the legal or legislative level. But I think what we're seeing in Gwinnett, I have to say, it's also part of a natural thing. We're not California. We're not New York. Immigrants here are new demographic. And as we mature in to where we live, we're going to see more people running. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now with Asian Americans.
All right. So, Jerry, that's one of the barriers. She's talking about some of the barriers to running. But why are there such low voter numbers, especially among the non-white populations in Gwinnett?
Well, let's actually look at the numbers. In 2003, Gwinnett County only had 803 Latinos registered to vote. As of 2012, after we did a surname match of the electorate, there are 32,623 Latino voters in Gwinnett County. Gwinnett County represents—
Out of how many eligible? Do you know?
I don't know how many eligible, but Gwinnett County represents 18% of the total Latino population in the state. So Gwinnett County is significant as far as it comes to the Latino vote. That being said, adding on to some of the things that Helen said, there are structural barriers that are keeping people out. Number one, language access is a big issue that needs to be contended with both in Gwinnett County and various other counties. But number two, how does one become a state representative? Local elections matter, and local elections in Gwinnett County are all run in at-large voting processes. Those processes have been found by the federal courts when there's a significant shift in demographics that these processes are discriminatory against minority populations. And that's the reality in Gwinnett County, is that these systems, the pipeline to get new people into elected office, is rigged against minority communities. And that's why we don't have there's very structural issues that are keeping our communities out. Number one, politicians don't reach out to them. Number two, there's language barriers associated with that. Number three, the system is rigged against the minority populations in these situations.
All right.
I want to add one bit of good news, though, which is that looking back, when we crunched the numbers between the last two midterm elections, everyone knows nationally voter turnout was depressed,
right,
from the last midterms. Same here in the state. Except for Asian American voters, Asian American turnout increased by 25%.
Oh, wow.
Between 2010 and 2014.
Are you talking about in Georgia?
In Georgia, it went up by over two percentage points, while overall turnout in Georgia went down by 1.8 percentage points. So there is movement. We are moving ahead clip by clip. That shouldn't scare people. Again, I think that's a natural outcome of the maturation of immigrant communities and hopefully the hard work of groups like ours.
And the same can be said about the Latino voter turnout. In the 2008 election, Latino voter participation rate was at 56%. Nationally, it was at 47% in Gwinnett County. So there's significant engagement of the Latino electorate. In the 2012 election, Latino voter participation rate nationally was 48%, and in Gwinnett County, it was 49%. So there has been an effort to outpace national voter participation, but there is definitely some room for improvement.
Okay, so Andra, I'm glad you're here to help me put some of this all into context. I mean, Jerry is saying something that's relatively serious. He's saying that the electoral process here is rigged. Mm-hmm. Help me understand what that means. Are we talking about, we often refer to that in terms of gerrymandering, mm-hmm, drawing districts where one party is stronger than the other. But do we have barriers in terms of language and other things to people getting out to vote?
Well, yes, in terms of voter education, and then also in terms of people feeling confident about their ability to be able to vote and actually also to understand their vote. So if there's nobody, say, at the polls on election day who could help you translate a ballot, then that's going to be a deterrent to somebody voting, because nobody wants to go to the polls and feel that they're ill-informed or feel like they have to ask for help. And so you need to empower people ahead of time in order to be able to do that. I mean, I think this relates very strongly to the environment that we're in now with parts of the Voting Rights Act being invalidated. And so with parts of the Voting Rights Act being invalidated, we can't go to the federal courts and make a Section 4 claim, for instance, to say that Gwinnett County might need to redraw its
districts. Section 4 was the
part of the Voting Rights Act that was invalidated in Shelby County versus Holder.
Right.
So so what Jerry's talking about is something that people noticed in the early 1980s in Mobile, Alabama, for instance, where everything in Mobile was done via at-large districts. African-Americans happened to live in one concentrated area in Mobile. If they had drawn district lines, then you could have more than likely guaranteed that an African-American would have been elected from at least one part of Mobile. But when black candidates had to run district-wide, blacks made up a significant but still minority of the population in Mobile. So if there was racially polarized voting, then blacks could never actually win an outright majority vote so that they could get elected to city
office. Are you saying
office.
That's what's happening here?
And that is what's happening in Gwinnett County if everything is based on at-large systems. And it's also somewhat ironic that in Gwinnett County you still have this type of white control, and that people haven't talked about incorporation in the same way, because there may be avenues for incorporation to actually be beneficial to minorities, mm-hmm, in Gwinnett County, whereas in DeKalb and Fulton counties, what you saw were Republicans who felt like they were being underrepresented. Some people might argue that whites felt that they were being underrepresented in county government, and so they pushed for incorporation of areas like Sandy Spring and Brookhaven and Dunwoody so that they actually had greater opportunities to be able to run for office. because they felt that Democrats and maybe implicitly African-Americans were the ones who were actually being overrepresented in terms of county government leadership in those little in those southern counties.
Let me go to you, Helen, then. We've talked a little bit about language, and one of the complaints you often hear is we can't have somebody available for everyone. You have all these immigrants coming from, for example, for Asian Americans all over Asia. We can't have somebody there who speaks Thai and somebody who there who speaks Japanese. How do you handle language?
Well, you know, again, our organization provides multilingual information, education, and services around voting. But from that perspective, I don't think the ask from our organization or organizations like us would be, you know, have a translator and interpreter for every single language humanly possible. We're talking about certain high concentrated, limited English proficient groups. And in Gwinnett County, it looks like it's very likely at the end of 2016 that the census will identify Spanish as a language that must that Gwinnett County must translate the ballots into in accordance with the minority language provisions of the Voting Rights Act. Second and third to the Spanish-speaking populations are Korean and Vietnamese. So that the whole how they calculate that is another arduous, long discussion. But absolutely, over 40% of Asian Americans in Georgia are limited English proficient.
Yeah.
That's the number one issue why people that we've surveyed feel somewhat intimidated to going to the polls and vote. That's why we do a lot of absentee balloting. But whether Gwinnett County must do it or Gwinnett County voluntarily chooses to partner with groups like ours and does it on their own, that's something that we really look forward to. And I think the county is open to looking into options. So,
And it is a responsibility of government to ensure that they can provide services for its citizens. And
right.
These citizens need these language services. They should provide those services.
That's a portion of my interview with Jerry Gonzalez. He is the executive director of the Georgia Association of Latino Elected Officials. I also spoke with Andra Gillespie, a political science professor at Emory University, and Helen Ho, the former director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice in Atlanta. That conversation took place last April. We reached out to Gwinnett County for a statement regarding the recent lawsuit. They replied, "We are not in a position to comment on this litigation. Our attorneys will be reviewing the lawsuit that has been filed in federal court but not yet served on Gwinnett County. After thorough review, attorneys will brief the Board of Commissioners and the Board of Registrations and Elections," end quote. That's our show for today, but as always, we want to hear from you, and I wonder if you're concerned about voting rights where you live. Do you think some laws have weakened the strength of your vote, or have you ever had any trouble voting? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. I'm at Celeste Headley. The show is at OSD Talk, or you can post on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.